His interview smirk, that anti-intellectual bravado, was jarring. On the very same page, the very same day, Times op-ed columnist Thomas Friedman described Bush's reaction as the exact opposite of a smirk. Quote, "It was the quail in the headlights look." So which was it? Cocky smirk or stupid frightened stare? Whatever. The point was, the quiz was major news. The media's own lunatic overreaction turned the story into World War III. Contrarily, the press maintained radio silence on stories embarrassing to Gore. For example, as long as we're on the subject of world leaders, Al Gore couldn't pick George Washington out of a lineup. In a highly publicized stop at Monticello during Clinton's 1993 inaugural festivities, Gore pointed to the carvings of Washington and Benjamin Franklin and asked the curator, "Who are those guys?" He was surrounded by reporters and TV cameras when he said it. Only three newspapers reported the gaffe. The pop quiz soon raised a delicate matter even more urgent than Bush bashing. How many answers should the opinion makers lyingly claim they could have gotten right? Eventually, the blabocracy bravely settled on only two as the appropriate answer. This was probably because Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor, admitted he would have known the answer to only two. Noticeably, only two well-known commentators admitted that they could have identified only one of the world leaders, the same one Bush got, George Will and Chris Matthews. Say what you will about Will and Matthews, neither can be accused of lacking intellectual confidence. A fairly extensive LexisNexis search turns up only two people who claimed they could have named all four leaders, a Democrat pundit on Fox News' Hannity and Combs named Jenny, and Al Gore. The media's fanatical obsession with Bush's minor slips of tongue says nothing about Bush's intelligence, and everything about how liberals demean their political opponents rather than argue with them. Every human being occasionally stumbles over words. Only Republicans have their stumbles giddily repeated ad nauseam, analyzed and used as epithets, until more Americans can recite a simple slip of tongue by a Republican than can place the Civil War in the correct century. You would think the geniuses in the media had never made a mistake themselves. The often lengthy and hilarious corrections section of the New York Times belies that impression. The New York Times launched one of its typical substantiveless sneers at George W. Bush's intelligence when he first considered running for president in March 1999. Quote, "Mr. Bush has embarked on a cram course that could be titled, What You Need to Know to Run for President. There may never have been a serious candidate who needed it more." A correction, issued 4 days later, stated that the last sentence was not supposed to appear in the article, but was a message between editors after the article was written that somehow ended up in the text. Throughout impeachment, commentators were constantly calling Clinton Nixon, and to this day say impeach when they mean remove, as in President Clinton was not impeached. Months after he left office, impeached former President Bill Clinton was introduced by a member of the New York Historical Society as Richard Nixon. Over on NBC, John McLaughlin, no slouch, made what came to be a very common slip, referring to Whitewater as Watergate. Even TV personalities with teleprompters and earpieces who only have to speak coherently for an hour a day are constantly making verbal slips that would never be forgotten if they passed the lips of George Bush on his 14th campaign stop in a single day. Turn on a TV news program right now and you'll see one. Word stumbles by Democratic politicians are hard to come by, inasmuch as they are not recycled endlessly in peevish Maureen Dowd columns. Democrat errors are buried, forgotten, ignored, and lied about. Sometimes they are even falsely attributed to Republicans. When absolutely forced to report on a Democrat's gaffe, the media insistently include a Republican's error as well, so that it can be reported that both candidates are idiots. One of the more outrageous examples of the media cushioning a Democrat's error with an alleged error by a Republican, concerned Clinton's bungling incomprehension of what the Patriot missile does. In a campaign speech on September 8, 1992, Clinton said, "We come up with great ideas and then turn them into things like the Patriot missile, which will go through doors and down chimneys." This was an extremely embarrassing error about missile technology. The Patriot missile is a purely defensive missile. It is a surface-to-air missile designed to shoot down incoming missiles, not objects on the ground like chimneys. If it were possible for impressions to be reinforced about Democrats, Clinton's mistake might have been said to reinforce impressions that he knew nothing about the military. National defense was arguably even more important than the proper spelling of potato. Dan Quayle quickly rejoined that Clinton had confused the Patriot missile with the cruise missile. Bill Clinton knows less about national security than I do about spelling. This is how the mainstream media reported on Clinton's gaffe and Quayle's retort. The Los Angeles Times said, Quayle had to extract both feet from his own mouth. He too had the wrong missile. Time magazine said, Quayle tweaked Clinton for referring in a speech to Patriot missiles going down chimneys during the Gulf War. Ha, said Quayle, Bill Clinton knows less about national security than I do about spelling. The weapons, said Quayle, were cruise missiles. Join the club, Dan, they were smart bombs. CNN's Frederick Allen said that, quote, neither side had much luck when it came to discussing national security, because actually these things are called smart bombs, which gives them a distinction from the candidates. Who was right? The combined intellectual firepower of the Los Angeles Times, Time Magazine, and CNN, or Dan Quayle? The answer is Dan Quayle. Neither the cruise missile nor smart bombs literally go down chimneys, but in theory both could, and about equally well. Thus, when talking about weapons that can go down chimneys and through doors, it would be accurate to refer to either cruise missiles or smart bombs. By contrast, the Patriot missile, identified by Clinton as going down chimneys, has nothing whatsoever to do with precise targeting. But the media was so determined to call Quayle an idiot, they could not bear reporting that Quayle had caught Clinton making a mistake. So they simply lied and reported that Quayle was wrong, too. If accurately correcting a Democrat makes you an idiot, God help any Republican who misplaces a syllable. In the 2000 presidential election, the ABC News website carefully cataloged Bush's every word slip in a section titled The English Patient. There was no One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest section for Gore's incessant lies. Indeed, the misstatements of Democrats are extremely difficult to come by, inasmuch as no record of them is meticulously compiled by media watchdogs. Shockingly, though, Democrats are not infallible either. Here are a few Democratic blunders that somehow made their way into the public record. Bill Clinton. This is still the greatest country in the world if we just will steel our wills and lose our minds. Bill Clinton. They've managed to keep their unemployment low, although their overall unemployment is high. United States Senator Barbara Boxer. Those who survived the San Francisco earthquake said, "Thank God I'm still alive." But of course, those who died, their lives will never be the same again. Former Attorney General Janet Reno, I always wait until a jury has spoken before I anticipate what they will do. Al Gore, a zebra cannot change its spots. This was given in a speech on the Senate floor in September 1991, but was later edited out of the congressional record. For truly appalling grammar, nothing beats Hillary's scandal patois. Legal troubles always seem to bring out the hillbilly in her. During the 60 Minutes interview, when the Clintons lied to the country about Jennifer Flowers, Hillary's ersatz Arkansas twang was virtually unlistenable. I'm not sitting here, some little woman standing by my man like Tammy Wynette. I'm sitting here because I love him, and I honor what he's been through and what we've been through together. And you know, if that's not enough for people, then heck, don't vote for him. Particularly grating is Hillary's Valley Girl penchant for saying real when she means really. When asked at a press conference on Whitewater about her failing health care plan, she began, I think that's a real important question. During the lying 60 Minutes interview, she said, I think it's real dangerous in this country if we don't have some zone of privacy for everybody. The only solace is knowing that listening to that must have been like nails on a blackboard for every single New York Times reporter. Meanwhile, Vanity Fair actually psychoanalyzed Bush's misstatements, purporting to have proved him dyslexic. This was absolutely not liberals avoiding real issues. To the contrary, Bush's occasional misstatements were a matter of grave national importance. As author Gail Sheehy explained, dyslexics develop rigidity, needing the comfort of following a known path. By total happenstance, this is exactly what liberals say about all conservatives, with or without any phony dyslexia diagnoses. The left's dogmatic refusal to acknowledge any facts that contradict their ideology, such as the now dispositive data on concealed carry laws, is known as thinking outside the box. In a charming populist touch, Sheehy claimed Bush's Christianity was a symptom of his mental defect. It seems Christianity filled a psychological need for structure and a spiritual discipline common to many dyslexics. Citing experts, Sheehy proclaimed that Bush's apocryphal dyslexia could affect his performance as president. If liberals truly believed verbal fluency were determinative of IQ, why did they call Reagan dumb? The peculiar liberal obsession with verbal facility as a proxy for IQ seemed to recede a bit when the great communicator was president. Instead of hailing Reagan as the greatest genius ever to inhabit the White House, his very facility with words was derided as the vocational faculty of a hackneyed actor. When he was over 80 years old, having left public office 4 years earlier, Reagan made an incredibly minor slip during his speech to the 1992 Republican National Convention. The refrain to his speech was a quote from John Adams, "Facts are stubborn things." Reagan stated the refrain flawlessly half a dozen times, but in one single rendition of it, he said, "Facts are stupid things, stubborn things, I should say." That one-syllable slip quickly became the greatest Republican error since Watergate. Reagan's monumental idiocy in making a minor slip has been cited in at least 4 books and flogged in 77 news articles on LexisNexis. Soon liberals began embellishing on the word slip to claim Reagan had gotten the quote wrong, claiming it was not a verbal slip at all, but a misquotation. This called for snippy remarks from all the Adams experts in the media. A book review in the New York Times noted that many famous and successful people had little regard for history. C.F. Ronald Reagan, "Facts are stupid things." An article in the Dallas Morning News said Reagan had misquoted John Adams, saying Reagan's version was, "Facts are stupid things." A column in the Los Angeles Times suggested Reagan was, quote, "making up something stupid on his own." Bush occasionally misspeaks and therefore he's an idiot. Reagan spoke mellifluously, which proved he was an idiot, except the one time he finally fumbled a word, which also demonstrated he was an idiot. You can't win with these people. All a Republican can do is die. On the left's theory that misspeaking is a searing gauge of intelligence, Gore was an imbecile. Subliminable, for example, is a lot closer to subliminal than was the inspiration for Love Story is to knew the guy who wrote Love Story. Bush may stumble over his words on occasion, as does every human. At least he never claimed he fought at the Alamo. Liberals are not only incapable of explaining a conservative position, they censor conservative views from their media. Instead of arguing substantive issues, liberals prefer to drone on and on about the larger cosmic meaning of Bush saying subliminable. It's as if they believe allowing an articulate statement of the conservative position to escape into the world will put a religious hex on them. Until you can intelligently articulate the other side's position, you are not an adult. You are a liberal. For those easily duped by media propaganda, there would be no more staggering surprise than George W. Bush's masterful response to a devastating terrorist attack 7 months after he took office. Never was the myth of a dumb Republican shattered with such dispatch. Stupid old Reagan won the Cold War, but that took time. It was the gradual, if inevitable, outcome of Reagan's massive defense buildup, military invasions, support for anti-communist insurgents around the globe, and finally walking away from the table at Reykjavik. Unfortunately for liberals, a surprise attack on America on September 11, 2001, would test George W. Bush like no other president in United States history. It was precisely the risk of something like a terrorist attack happening that sent the media into anxious reveries about Bush's performance on Andy Hiller's pop quiz. How on earth could Bush be expected to handle a national crisis if he couldn't name the Prime Minister of Swaziland? Dr. Barnabas Sibusiso Dlamini. Bush's alleged weaknesses, subjected to side-splitting ridicule throughout the campaign, were precisely those that would be most severely tested in the crucible of war. Contrary to urgent news bulletins throughout the campaign, Bush was a masterful leader. War was where the rubber met the road, and Bush was the consummate wartime commander. The media had lied, and now everyone knew it. Far from smirking bravado, Bush exuded calm deliberation. He didn't overreact with a quick, ostentatious display of pyrotechnics, as Democrats are wont to do. Indeed, in a direct rebuke to the Clinton administration, Bush pointedly said, "When I take action, I'm not going to fire a $2 million missile at a $10 empty tent and hit a camel in the butt. It's going to be decisive." The very opposite of an incurious frat boy, Bush inspired the nation and showed the world America's resolve. In one of the most eloquent speeches in American history, he proclaimed, "As long as the United States of America is determined and strong, this will not be an age of terror. This will be an age of liberty here and across the world." Describing a new and confusing enemy, Bush said, "We have seen their kind before. They are the heirs of all the murderous ideologies of the 20th century. By sacrificing human life to serve their radical visions, by abandoning every value except the will to power, they follow in the path of fascism, Nazism, and totalitarianism. And they will follow that path all the way to where it ends, in history's unmarked grave of discarded lies." The dyslexic retard delivered the speech flawlessly. New York Times columnist Bob Herbert called it a near-perfect speech. For someone who always hangs out with the bad crowd, Herbert's first impulses are almost always good. Most impressively, in word and deed, the president emboldened a jittery nation. "The course of this conflict is not known, yet its outcome is certain. Freedom and fear, justice and cruelty have always been at war, and we know that God is not neutral between them. Fellow citizens, we will meet violence with patient justice, assured of the rightness of our cause and confident of the victories to come. In all that lies before us, may God grant us wisdom and may He watch over the United States of America." America had a leader who said what he meant and meant what he said, and just in the nick of time. Having cleared out the pizza boxes, women's panties, and other detritus of the Caligula administration, the country was finally being run by grown-ups again. The entire administration was a smooth, purring machine. Bush had assembled an astonishingly talented team of advisors and placed each in the perfect position. The nation could sleep well at night. The incurious frat boy would go on to demonstrate the value of real intelligence, courting world leaders with his charm and resolute determination. Importantly, Bush instantly forged a crucial alliance with the leader of a Muslim nation that had its own share of Islamic terrorists, but which bordered on Afghanistan. That leader was General Pervez Musharraf of Pakistan. One wonders how President Jenny would have done sealing that delicate deal. Musharraf, of course, was one of the leaders Bush had been unable to name in the celebrated Foreign Leaders Pop Quiz. The media's relentless campaign of portraying Bush as a frivolous ne'er-do-well had culminated just days before the election, when Senator Joseph Lieberman, Gore's running mate, solemnly raised the prospect of war. This was supposed to be an argument in favor of Al Gore. "When I think of a solitary figure standing in the Oval Office," he said, "weighing life and death decisions that can affect the security of our country and the stability of our world, I see Al Gore." But when war came, liberals were forced to confront their own demons, realizing with unmitigated relief that Al Gore was not the man standing in the Oval Office. Not long after the attack, the New York Times talked to a series of prominent Democrats, mostly off the record for obvious reasons. Uniformly, the Democrats sang Bush's praises and conceded that Gore would have been a disaster. Though Bush had been ceaselessly derided for his inability to talk, Democrats were now giving rave reviews to Bush's wartime pronouncements and questioning, quote, whether the former vice president would have been as nimble at communicating to the public. These prominent Democrats also heaped praise on Bush's advisors and, quote, questioned whether Mr. Gore would have surrounded himself with as experienced a foreign policy team as Mr. Bush. Shuddering at the thought of Gore's foreign policy advisors running a war against Afghanistan, one former, quote, top Clinton appointee, criticized the qualifications of those he expected to be Mr. Gore's foreign policy team. A, quote, staunch Gore supporter and former Democratic senator griped that Gore would have tried to micromanage everything. If you got your news from the news, all this would have come as a bolt out of the blue. Bush's most impressive qualities included every single point for which he had been demeaned during the campaign. When Bush was running for president, the typical news report on his leadership abilities went something like this. He flunked a foreign leader's pop quiz, doesn't know a Greek from a Grecian, was a C-average college student, can't remember what, if anything, he liked to read as a boy, and admits that, even today, he doesn't care to read weighty books on public policy, a subject that would seem unnatural for the governor of the second most populous state. Incidentally, public policy isn't a subject, and he was a C-average Yale student back in the days when it was still possible to get a C at Yale. Astonishingly, Bush had even been mocked for his advisors. New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman put the case this way. "A lot of people say that Mr. Bush, while he knows little foreign policy, has hired smart advisors. Oh, really? Well, what happens when his two smartest advisors disagree?" Somehow that devilish conundrum worked itself out. There was no question that it was Bush who was calling the shots. It was he who made the central decision to go after the entire Al-Qaeda terrorist organization after CIA Director George Tenet raised the sobering thought that Al-Qaeda was a 60-country problem. Not Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, not National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, not Secretary of State Colin Powell. Recall that the pop quiz had been treated like the Rosetta Stone of presidential qualifications. USA Today reported that Bush's performance on the pop quiz had intensified concerns that he lacks the intellectual heft to be commander-in-chief. Showing great prescience, the article also complained that Bush had made matters worse by appearing to put a positive spin on last month's military coup in Pakistan. This was the coup that installed General Musharraf, who became America's indispensable ally in the war on terrorism. New York Times columnist Friedman had claimed the pop quiz was important because it told us how Bush feels about these countries. Good call. Another Times columnist, Maureen Dowd, said Bush should have seen it coming. The question has been hanging out there for months about whether Bush the Younger knows enough about the world to deal with all the loons, coups, and wars that spring up like twisters across the post-Cold War plains. Time magazine triumphantly proclaimed that the quiz was as much a test of his political radar as of his foreign policy smarts. That article also made the inane argument that Bush was in no position to complain about a media ambush because his own education reforms required testing what students know before allowing them to advance to the next grade. This must have struck Newsweek's Jonathan Alter as a devastating critique, since he made the same incredibly weird point a week later. It was ironic, Alter said, that Bush had criticized social promotion in schools, and now he would be tested repeatedly by the press on his knowledge of foreign policy, where there would be no social promotion. Obviously, some portion of the population knew it was being lied to all along, and some portion of the population knew it was doing the lying. But there are also many people who mechanically adopt any and all fashionable platitudes. They will look you straight in the eye every 4 years for their entire insipid lives and insist that the Republican du jour is stupid. Share on Bush. He's stupid. When America was attacked, even that segment of the populace had to pull itself away from Lifetime TV for 5 minutes to watch the president. And suddenly, the media had some splaining to do. The Oracle of Delphi was fast losing credibility. Liberals couldn't just own up and admit they had lied about Bush, Coolidge, Eisenhower, Reagan, and Quayle. So instead, they began promoting an invasion of the body snatchers theory of Bush's performance in wartime. It seems like a perfectly plausible story to claim that war had miraculously transformed a dopey smirking frat boy into Super Bush. The only alternative was for the media to admit they had lied. Thus, the New York Times earnestly reported that Bush had been transformed. He had begun coming of age as president. Another Times article claimed, you could almost see him growing into the clothes of the presidency. Universal receptacle for liberal cliches, Richard Cohen of the Washington Post rolled out all the excuses in a single column, saying Bush had grown, risen to the occasion, gained confidence, and seemed emboldened by the heroism of others. In case it was still not clear that this was definitely not the same George Bush the media had relentlessly called an idiot and probably dyslexic, the New York Times observed that Bush had found the eloquence that has eluded him so often in the past. Another Times reporter detected in Bush a spontaneous new intensity and a new resolution in his voice. Democratic Representative Richard Gephardt remarked on how strong Bush had been these last few days. Bush's eloquent speeches were called a surprising development for a president who has often seemed rhetorically challenged. After praising Bush's speech, Times columnist Bob Herbert duly noted that Bush, quote, seldom wanders into the precincts of eloquence. Remember this when they call the next Republican stupid. In a single New York Times profile, a presidential candidate was repeatedly quoted using such expressions as, that's no good for sure, and isn't she cool? Telling a reporter he wanted to discuss big think ideas, he stammered, I can't say this, it's going to sound so weird. That was intellectual colossus Al Gore. Naturally, this led the New York Times to query, is Gore too smart to be president? Mr. Gore's challenge, the Times explained in that very article, is, quote, to show that he is a regular guy, despite a perceived surplus of gravitas, which at least some Americans seem to find intimidating. Or as Gore himself eruditely put it, weird. This is one of the grave injustices of the world. Democrats can run ridiculous and insubstantial men for important national offices, and no one will ever know because the media won't report it. It is as unthinkable to describe a Democrat as stupid as it is to describe a Republican as smart. The adversary press will finish a Democrat's sentences for him, defend his arguments, provide substantiation for his ludicrous claims, and refuse to report his mistakes. Gore is only the most recent Democratic mediocrity to dazzle media shills with his genius. Whenever the public fails to be similarly dazzled, the media leaps in to explain that the Democratic mediocrity is too smart to connect with ordinary voters. Thus, a columnist in the Los Angeles Times ruefully explained in the media's formulaic excuse that Gore was too smart for his own good. Sadly, the best and the brightest student, that's Gore here, doesn't always get to be class president. One of the first Democrats to have his vast unpopularity with voters attributed to his soaring intellect was Adlai Stevenson. Widely known as a lover of literature with an erudite wit, Stephen was supposed to be the thinking man's president. Though it was blindingly obvious at the time that Stevenson was a boob, certainly clear to the American people who continually rejected him for president, only later was Stevenson discovered to be a lowbrow who rarely read books. When he died, only a single book was found on his nightstand, The Social Register. This has been a 50-year game of the Emperor's New Brain, in which only true intellectuals, i.e. the media, are capable of discerning a Democrat's profound intellect. U.S. News and World Report wearily recounted the Herculean efforts the Clinton campaign was forced to undertake to conceal Clinton's towering intellect. His campaign staff, quote, took great pains to dumb down Clinton. The author snippily added that this won't be Bush's problem. Time magazine also addressed the question of how Clinton dealt with the problem of being so brilliant. In politics, it's not smart to seem too smart. Bill Clinton uses his intellect to dazzle audiences, but he does it in an inclusive way. He articulates the things most people know but can't quite express. The same article somberly reported that Hillary was the woman who knew too much. She sometimes can't help intimidating voters with her grasp of the issues. Other Democrats alleged to have been disadvantaged by their oversized intellects include Jimmy Carter, Walter Mondale, Michael Dukakis, and Bill Bradley. Also every other Democrat you've ever heard of. Dukakis was so smart he was unaware of his wife Kitty's 26-year addiction to diet pills. As the Los Angeles Times reported, Dukakis said he did not know of her habit until she underwent treatment in 1982. In light of Dukakis's renowned attention to detail, the Times said, even Kitty's sister was surprised at his professed ignorance. He also displayed his towering intellect by advising Iowa farmers during the 1988 campaign that they should be growing Belgian endive. Walter Mondale cleverly informed the voters in the middle of a campaign that he was going to raise their taxes. He also deftly sent his media strategist out to explain that the guy who had just walloped him in a debate was a senile old weakling. Jimmy Carter was so intelligent, he claimed to have been attacked by a killer rabbit during the 1980 campaign. In a nationally televised debate with Reagan, Carter smartly said that in preparation for the debate, he had solicited the opinion of his teenage daughter Amy on nuclear war. Senator Bill Bradley, Democrat of New Jersey, was well known to newspaper readers everywhere by his unofficial first name, Cerebral. The Boston Globe reported that unless the Cerebral Bill Bradley caught on, Gore appears to be the candidate. The San Francisco Chronicle said the Cerebral Bradley wants to talk about his many ideas about tax policy and defense restructuring. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch described Bradley's run-of-the-mill tax-and-spend liberalism as his cerebral approach to politics. The Boston Globe said Bradley exuded cerebral self-deprecation. And CNN political analyst and Los Angeles Times columnist Ron Brownstein informed CNN viewers that Bradley was cerebral. But then, whoops, it turned out Bradley got a 485 on his verbal SATs. That's cerebral for a Democrat. Dumb George Bush got a 566, which was lower than Gore's 625, but a lot higher than Bradley's 485. For those of you who took the SAT after 1994, all these scores would be higher under the new inflated scoring system. Let the record reflect that an octogenarian former Republican president who makes a one-syllable slip in an otherwise flawlessly delivered convention speech as an idiot. But a Democrat presidential candidate who gets a 485 on his SATs is cerebral. The cerebral Bradley's very non-Princetonian SAT score was not discovered by Time, Newsweek, or the New York Times. They were too busy with the hard-hitting investigative work of calling Bush dumb. Mr. Cerebral's SAT score was outed on the internet. But let's return to the media's most stunning accomplishment since persuading the public that Adlai Stevenson was not a bilious blowhard, turning Al Gore into a genius. Even with years of practice, this was quite a feat. Among Gore's big think ideas was his proposal to ban the internal combustion engine. In the 2000 presidential campaign, he paid a feminist $15,000 a month to teach him how to be a man. He said he created the internet. He claimed to be the inspiration for Love Story. He described his childhood, spent in the penthouse apartment of the Fairfax Hotel, as cleaning out hog waste, clearing land with an axe, and plowing hillsides with a team of mules. Gore couldn't identify George Washington and Benjamin Franklin at Monticello. In a 1994 speech, Gore got the country's motto backward, saying E pluribus unum, out of one, many. He called the Chicago Bulls forward Michael Jordan, Michael Jackson. This last mistake was written up in the Washington Post in an article that attributed the error to George Bush and was titled, Bush Gaffes Are Back as Debates Near. When it was Bush's mistake, the misstatement was big news. But when it turned out Gore had said it, it proved absolutely nothing and was promptly forgotten. Rather, the question on every journalist's mind was, will Gore's brainy earnestness deny him the larger prize, as USA Today said? Or as the New York Times put it, citing the thoughts of many, many perceive that Mr. Gore is too smart for his own good. In the unique analysis of U.S. News and World Report, Gore is very smart, but he is almost too smart. One of the formulaic benedictions for Gore was that he was the smartest kid in the class, as he was described in dozens of articles in the year 2000 alone. This was in dramatic contrast to Bush, who, in addition to not being the sharpest knife in the drawer, also ain't the smartest kid in the class, according to the New York Times, quoting others to maintain reportorial distance. But being the smartest kid in the class was not all sunshine and song. To be sure, it meant Gore was smart, but it was also supposed to explain why voters seemed not to like him. He was just too damned smart. Except it turned out, again in the harsh light of facts, just because no one liked him didn't mean Gore was the smartest kid in the class. Far from it. Gore's real school records were abominable. In high school, Gore received mostly C's and B's in English and history. He got all C's in French. Only in art classes did Gore earn straight A's, and he took a lot of art classes. Gore was admitted to Harvard, but he was the son of a prominent United States senator when applying to college. Oddly, it was Bush who was routinely accused of having sailed through life on his father's name. But the truth was the reverse. The media was manipulating the fact that, many years later, Bush's father became president. When Bush was admitted to Yale, his father was a little-known congressman on the verge of losing his first Senate race. His father was a Yale alumnus, but so were a lot of other boys' parents. It was Gore, not Bush, who had a famous father likely to impress college admissions committees. Having gotten into Harvard, at least in part on the basis of his father's prominence, Gore did not redeem himself. In his sophomore year at Harvard, Gore got one D, one C-minus, two C's, two C-pluses, and one B-minus. This, the Washington Post reported, placed him in the bottom fifth of the class for the second year in a row. Gore's grades that year were lower than any semester recorded on Bush's transcript from Yale. Conforming to the New York Times style book on how to report negative information about a Democrat, the Post slipped in an untrue and irrelevant pot shot at Bush. The Post headline was, Gore's grades belie image of studiousness. His school transcripts are a lot like Bush's. After college, Bush earned an MBA from Harvard. Gore failed out of divinity school and dropped out of law school at Vanderbilt University. Gore failed five of his eight classes at divinity school. Here's a question for modern philosophers. How many classes does a Democrat have to fail in order not to be called smart? Bolstering the media's message that Gore was very smart, maybe too smart, during the Democratic National Convention, an endless stream of Gore's friends and relatives took to the stage to issue personal testimonials about what a clever jokester Gore was in private. By the end of it all, you had to marvel at how well Gore had kept that amazing wit under wraps. He must reach Olympian heights when he's alone in the bathtub. His convention speech of a lifetime did bear witness to how his enormous cleverness seems to dissipate whenever anyone was watching. In the verbal equivalent of George Bush Sr. looking at his watch during the 1992 town hall debate, Gore could not read his speech fast enough. He just kept rushing through his windbag of a speech and stepping on his applause lines as if he wanted to spit out the whole garbled mess as quickly as possible and get back to the bathtub, where he really hits his humor stride. Bush couldn't name 3 foreign leaders. Gore couldn't name his own positions. On Meet the Press, Tim Russert asked Gore for his position on a bill that would prohibit the execution of pregnant women on death row. Gore's response was, and I quote, "I don't know what you're talking about." Russert tried restating the question several times, but Gore kept insisting he would need to know the circumstances. The only pertinent circumstances were fully contained within the question. A pregnant woman is on death row. Would you be for a law preventing her execution until she gives birth? Gore didn't know. The good part of being a Democrat is that you can commit crimes, sell out your base, bomb foreigners, and rape women, and the Democratic faithful will still think you're the greatest. The bad part is that you must effortlessly follow the party orthodoxy, which is completely impenetrable to human logic. Adhering to Democratic Party principles, the correct answer is, kill the fetus and spare the murderess. Since Democrats can't just come out and say that, the situation obviously called for hostile evasion. Though he had spent years studying with the master, Gore could not produce the proper Clinton-esque dodge. I've already answered that. This legislation is politically motivated. It's a private matter between the woman and her God. The question has been propounded by a vast right-wing conspiracy, and I didn't do it. Gore once claimed the biblical story of Cain and Abel was a parable about the dangers of pollution. Not original sin, not murder, not envy, pollution. Indeed, he wrote in his magnum opus, Earth in the Balance, the first instance of pollution in the Bible occurs when Cain slays Abel. According to Gore, God was hopping mad about Cain polluting. Cain had defiled the ground with Abel's messy blood. Murder is one thing, but polluting really got God's goat. In Gore's view, the Bible inveighs against global warming and the internal combustion engine, but has nothing of any relevance to say on the matter of killing the unborn. When pressed by the New York Times to expand upon his singular interpretation of the Cain and Abel story, Gore explained that God's original rebuff of Cain's offering of the fruit of the ground, which set off Cain's murderous jealousy and the first recorded case of pollution, was simply, quote, a metaphorical reference to the move from a herding to an agricultural economy. I don't know, God works in mysterious ways and all, but his repudiation of agricultural products doesn't seem like the most lucid manner of promoting an agricultural economy. Gore spent much of his campaign denying any memory of his legally questionable fundraising. Even Gore's campaign staff at the New York Times remarked on how often Gore's memory, considered to be quite excellent, fails. When asked on Fox News how it was that his subpoenaed White House emails got lost, the inventor of the internet protested that he was not an expert on computers. Of his Buddhist temple fundraiser, Gore said, "I'll tell you what I learned from it, which is that we need campaign finance reform." So by virtue of breaking the law, he was in a better position to reform it? The easiest path to being recognized as a genius in America is to become a completely predictable, run-of-the-mill, redistributionist Democrat. Then no matter how dumb you are and how many ludicrous lies you keep telling, the media will only remark on your dazzling brilliance. Gore explained that it wasn't a fundraiser. It was an event to raise funds. He's a modern Wittgenstein. In the classic adversary media approach, during the 2000 presidential campaign, Good Morning America rigorously grilled both Bush and Gore on a misstatement made by Bush. To provide some context, at this point in the campaign, Gore had claimed the following. He had discovered Love Canal. In fact, it had already been declared a national disaster area by President Carter months before Gore noticed it. His father was voted out of office for his courageous stand on civil rights, though his father voted against the 1964 Civil Rights Act. His mother sang him a Union lullaby in his crib. This is highly unlikely, inasmuch as his father had just cast a major anti-labor vote, and the song didn't exist until Al Jr. was 27 years old. He was a co-sponsor of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform bill, an impossibility since he never served in Congress with Senator Feingold. He had taken a, quote, risk in asking the former prime minister of Russia to get personally involved in Kosovo. though President Boris Yeltsin of Russia had already designated Mr. Chernomyrdin as special envoy to the Balkans weeks earlier. And Gore also claimed he had created the internet and been the inspiration for Love Story. Yikes! Thus, the question put to Gore by Jack Ford on Good Morning America was this. Governor Bush was asked a question about hate crimes law in Texas, and, as part of his answer, he stressed the fact that three men had been sentenced to death as a result of the killing of James Byrd. Well, it turns out that he's wrong. Only two men were sentenced to death there. Is that the type of error, the type of mistake, that the Bush campaign has criticized you for making? Bush's misstatement was also the topic of Ford's interview with Bush. Ford, you had said during the course of your response in the debate that the three people involved in the death of James Byrd were going to get the ultimate penalty, death penalty. Governor Bush, yeah, unfortunately, I was wrong. Two of them are going to get the ultimate penalty. Ford, two will get the death penalty. Governor Bush, three maybe should have, but the jury decided otherwise. Ford, the question that people will ask now is that, however, the kind of error that you've criticized the vice president for making? Governor Bush, of course not, no. Ford, why not? Governor Bush, I'm telling you right now, it's two instead of three. Ford then asked Bush if he was an inexperienced dope. Ford probed Bush on, quote, questions about your experience, the fact that you never held a job that dealt with foreign policy, and questions about your intelligence, your ability to grasp presidential issues. Gore was asked, quote, as the Vice President of the United States, you've had a distinguished career in the House and in the Senate, and yet you find yourself on a stage in front of family members and tens of millions of people with a moderator asking questions about your integrity and your credibility. Does that hurt? Does that hurt? Can you imagine this question being asked of a Republican? No. Can you imagine this question being asked of an adult? After Ford had vigorously cross-examined both candidates on Bush's misstatement, asked Bush if he was stupid and Gore if he hurt, former Clinton hatchet man George Stephanopoulos wrapped up with ABC's signature objective political analysis. The fact that Gore claimed to have invented the internet was never mentioned on any Good Morning America broadcast except a few times when Bush referred to it, nor was it discussed on NBC's Today Show. Also not mentioned on either Good Morning America or The Today Show were Gore's claims about Love Canal or Love Story, or his inability to identify George Washington at Monticello. This is not meant to suggest that any other morning shows did cover Gore's misstatements. These just happened to be the only searches I ran. Indeed, Gore's astonishing claim about being the prime mover on the internet might not ever have been heard on any ABC morning broadcast if Bush hadn't raised Gore's delusional internet claim in his own campaign ads. Those ads were mentioned on ABC news segments in order to denounce Bush for, quote, attacking Al Gore. Gore's inanities became well known only through the voice of non-elite America, and only because Gore's misstatements were so raucously funny. Gems like Gore's claiming to have invented the internet tended to capture the imaginations of FM disc jockeys, sports announcers, and late-night comics. While media blowhards raved about Gore's colossal intellect, every time the public actually heard Gore, they laughed at him for being such a dork. It's always so great to see the reaction of normal Americans to Democrats, unfiltered by the courtier press. The dichotomy didn't start with Gore. The classic media-human split concerned Clinton's truth-telling. Law professors and legal pundits ponderously described President Clinton's grand jury testimony as legally accurate. The D.C. grand jury laughed out loud when they heard it. The same journalist-American dichotomy occurred every time the public got a gander at Al Gore, unfiltered by the media propaganda machine. Like Tolstoy's unhappy families, Gore was always strange, but he was strange in different ways. In the first debate, he was his natural self, Little Miss Know-It-All, Yugoslavia, as they call Serbia, plus Montenegro. In the second debate, he overcompensated and became Norman Bates in the last scene of Psycho. Gore was so tightly wound, you could almost hear him thinking, I hope they are watching. They will see. They will see and say why she wouldn't even hurt a fly. Naturally, therefore, the entire nation was on tenterhooks, waiting to see what new weirdness Gore would unleash during the third debate. It was brown-noser Tracy Flick from the movie Election. Even the audience was laughing at Gore for his ridiculous pomposity. Bush was in on the joke, laughing and winking at audience members as Gore grew increasingly insufferable. It was in that final debate that Bush said Gore's budget would require three times the spending Clinton had proposed. Gore butted in, as he was wont to do, with this dazzling retort. That's in an ad, Jim, that was knocked down by the journalist who analyzed the ad and said it was misleading. The journalists, Gore proclaimed, are the keepers of the scorecard. Oh, the journalists. The journalists said Bush's ad was misleading. The same journalists who had been browbeating the nation with the information that Gore was an intellectual titan. In fact, Gore's auxiliary staff in the media hadn't said what Gore claimed they said. The only mention of the ad was in the New York Times, which supported Bush's statement about Gore's spending plans, but nitpicked that the ad's 10-second description of Bush's plan was, quote, somewhat misleading. So Fibber McGee's citation of the journalists referred to a stupid quibble made by a partisan newspaper about a non-germane point in Bush's ad. For every media lie, Gore is a genius, there is invariably a second auxiliary backup lie sheltering the first lie. The media exaggerates Gore's mistakes. Thus, while the major media censored Gore's incessant misstatements with an iron fist, they simultaneously criticized themselves for being so tough on Gore. There was a virtual cottage industry in phony self-criticism about their maltreatment of poor, put-upon Al Gore. CBS Evening News, for example, mentioned Gore's internet bluster only once, in order to denounce media coverage of Al Gore as having been dominated by trivia. It was just that sort of trivia that had been carefully avoided at ABC, NBC, and CBS. The typical mention of Gore's internet boast was this from ABC's World News Now. Quote, after months of promising not to go negative, the Bush campaign is going negative. It's not about the issues, it's about Gore's character. Why this ad now? It worked for Bush once before going negative. An example of hard news coverage about a serious issue was Bush's mispronunciation of subliminal. That was not paltry trivia like Gore claiming to have invented the internet. Bush's word slip merited three separate mentions on CBS Evening News shows. It was also a news item on NBC's Today Show and ABC's World News Tonight. The Washington Monthly complained of exaggerations or even publishing outright falsehoods about Gore. Gore's college roommate set up a supposedly nonpartisan website called The Daily Howler to expose the media's ceaseless attacks on Al Gore. An immaterial misquote in Gore's lie about Love Canal was seized upon as an example of how Gore couldn't get a fair shake from the media. The Love Canal incident began when Gore told a high school audience that he, quote, found Love Canal. He explained how he was led to Love Canal by a letter he received from a high school girl alerting him to toxic waste in Toone, Tennessee. Quote, I called for a congressional investigation and a hearing. I looked around the country for other sites like that. I found a little place in upstate New York called Love Canal, had the first hearing on that issue, and Toone, Tennessee. That was the one you didn't hear of, but that was the one that started it all. The problem was that Gore's hearings were held in March 1979, well after Love Canal had been declared a national disaster area. Indeed, it was one of the major news stories of 1978, with front-page stories showing hundreds of people being evacuated from Love Canal. But Gore's lie became the prime example of how the media maliciously twisted Gore's statements. It seems that the Washington Post and the New York Times had misreported Gore's last sentence as, I was the one that started it all, as opposed to, that was the one that started it all. This was the only part of Gore's statement that anyone ever claimed the newspapers got wrong. But the thing is, changing I to that didn't change what Gore said from being false to being true. He plainly said that after his Toone, Tennessee hearings, he had looked around the country and found Love Canal. That, he said, started it all. Neither I, Gore, nor that, his Toone, Tennessee hearings, started anything regarding Love Canal. Still, a non-germane misquote from Gore's Love Canal boast was supposed to demonstrate the press's unfair attacks on Al Gore. Headlines on articles about the alleged misquote proclaimed, Gore more victimized than guilty of falsehoods, press critics say. An article in the Atlantic Journal and Constitution ruefully said the misquote was a textbook example of how people have come to view the veracity of candidates and reporters. Writing in the Washington Monthly, Robert Perry claimed the Love Canal flap was created when the press, quote, misquoted Gore and then was amplified endlessly by the rest of the news media. The endless amplification consisted of Gore's misstatement, never passing the lips of anyone on NBC or CBS News, and being mentioned one time on ABC. That was when Clinton aide George Stephanopoulos observed that Gore's misstatement was merely a senator's slip, and that Gore had fixed it, by accusing the press of misquoting him, apparently. Historian Douglas Brinkley accused the media of engaging in a game of gotcha with the Love Canal incident. He claimed Gore, quote, could argue that he was talking about the Tennessee site being the one that he found. To restate the facts, Gore said, I found a little place in upstate New York called Love Canal, end quote. Also preposterously billed as myth by the watchdog media was Gore's claim that he had invented the internet. New York Times columnist Paul Krugman asserted, true, Mr. Gore didn't invent the internet, but then he never said he had. Slate's Mickey Kouse pronounced Gore's internet boast minor and excusable. You see, technically, precisely what Gore said was this, quote, I took the initiative in creating the internet, end quote. This is supposed to be completely different from claiming that he had invented the internet. In point of fact, create is a synonym for invent. Any thesaurus will quickly confirm this. If Gore said he took the initiative to create, develop, devise, or produce the internet, all of those would be false. An accurate paraphrase is not untrue simply for being a paraphrase. If Gore had said he invented the internet in French, he still would have said he invented the internet, and it still would have been preposterous. Like all propagandists, liberals create mythical enemies to justify their own viciousness and advance their agenda. There is no boogeyman that strikes greater terror in the left than the apocryphal religious right. The very phrase is a meaningless concept, an inverted construct of the left's own Marquis de Sade lifestyle. It functions as a talismanic utterance to rally the faithful against anyone who disagrees with the well-organized conspiratorial left. Despite the constant threat of the religious right in America, there is evidently no such thing as the atheist left. In a typical year, the New York Times refers to either Christian conservatives or the religious right almost 200 times. But in a LexisNexis search of the entire New York Times archives, the phrases atheist liberals or the atheist left do not appear once. Only deviations from the left-wing norm merit labels. The point of the phrase religious right or Christian conservative is not to define but to belittle. It informs the reader that the object of the sobriquet is presumptively insane by saying he is a member of it. The religious right serves the function of Emmanuel Goldstein in Orwell's 1984. The program of the 2 minutes hate varied from day to day, but there was none in which Goldstein was not the principal figure. He was the primal traitor, the earliest defiler of the party's purity. All subsequent crimes against the party, all treacheries, acts of sabotage, heresies, deviations, sprang directly out of his teaching. Though neither religious nor right, nor even religious right, are inherently insulting terms, they are thrown out as if they are accusations. The media is repelled by the people it believes these terms describe. Just as some people once spat out the word Jew as an insult, causing polite people to start using convoluted euphemisms like person of the Hebrew faith, religious right has become a slur by usage. In one of the most astonishing uses of religious right to mean lunatic, the New York Times explained that after September 11, 2001, leaders in Saudi Arabia were hesitant to crack down on militant clerics for fear that it would, quote, have inflamed the religious right. In addition to jihad, do crazed homicidal Muslims support devolution of power to the states? During the 2000 election, the New York Times praised John McCain for attacking the religious right, saying his message was badly needed and cannot be dismissed. Though the editorial did gently chastise McCain for having withdrawn an earlier characterization of them as evil, it went on to denounce the religious right for exercising a bullying influence on politics. Unlike the calm persuasion on display daily at the Times, the religious right was eroding the spirit of tolerance. It is a thesis of long-standing at the New York Times that the religious right is tyrannical because it has opinions at odds with the editorial page of the New York Times. In 1996, Times columnist A.M. Rosenthal denounced the religious right delegates, the religious right is now a state, for supporting Bob Dole at the Republican National Convention, provided they, quote, control what he and the party do and say, and where the party is going. That is agenda number one. Apparently, other delegates were eagerly hoping to have their issues buried or forgotten by the party. Implicitly, sometimes quite explicitly, the devil words religious right connote irrationality, inflexibility, simple-mindedness, and judgmentalism. In 1993, the Washington Post informed its readers that the religious right, or the gospel lobby, is composed of people who are, quote, largely poor, uneducated, and easy to command. A correction the next day admitted that there was no factual basis for that statement. Attempting its own definition of the religious right, the New York Times reported in 1986, evangelical Christians are more easily led than other kinds of voters. The Times cited a college professor as its authority. Without the pretend accuracy, San Francisco Chronicle columnist Arthur Hopp described the religious right as a woman named Maud who wants to slog through the snow down to the Grange to pray for Pap Buchanan. Unlike Maud, Hopp explained, left-wing sophisticates are far too busy sampling restaurants, discussing films, or discovering their inner Epicurean. This sneering account of Maud was intended to explain how such a comically ridiculous bunch as the religious right kept winning at the polls. Maud, imaginary Maud, has nothing else to do, Hopp explained. Maud doesn't jog, cruise the internet, read Danielle Steele, play golf, or otherwise waste her time. Or apparently, sample restaurants. Revealingly, Hopp added, these folks certainly have a right to their beliefs. Gee, thanks. Free speech is always a wildly counterintuitive concept for liberals. They believe free speech is something liberals magnanimously bestow on others. No matter how loath Dan Rather is on the right, it would never occur to any conservative to proclaim that Rather, personally, on his own time, has a right to his beliefs. Having generously conceded that religious conservatives have a right to their beliefs, Hopp immediately demanded to know, what can be done to save the country from this dedicated minority? A guest on National Public Radio described the religious right as, quote, a very, very vocal minority with a lot of money that's doing most of the unconstitutional stuff out there. This was in contradistinction to the majority, who really don't want to bother with how I believe and really don't want to bother with forcing anybody to do anything that's against their will. So the religious right is a very, very small minority whose goal is to force people to do things against their will, populated by an army of easily led cornpones. They are fire-breathing, sell out our children in the name of religion, and enjoy narrowly defining the rights of others. Also, evil. It's hard to imagine that such an intolerant bunch would have much leverage no matter how vocal they are. But according to the frequent religious right updates in the press, this revolting minority possesses a staggering amount of influence, all while operating under the watchful eye of a hostile media. So powerful is the left's imaginary enemy that Norman Lear, a multimillionaire TV producer, was said to have walked away from his primetime kingdom to found People for the American Way for the sole purpose of combating the political influence of the religious right. Imagine the sermons drung if a conservative group purported to represent the American way. Referring to the powerful influence of the religious right, the Los Angeles Times has estimated its strength at a third or more of the primary vote in many states. The Economist magazine put it at about a fifth. In 1998, Fortune magazine called the Christian Coalition alone the seventh most powerful lobbying group in Washington. None of the figures about the religious right ever add up. The facts marshaled to demonstrate that this scary group is bent on total domination of America instantly collapse under the most cursory examination. And the members of the scheming religious right cannot be identified beyond the description of a fictitious character named Maud. Eventually, the New York Times set its logicians to cracking how such a small minority intent on forcing people to do things against their will could wield such vast power. The key to the disproportionate influence of the religious right, despite its universal unpopularity at the Times, was, first, money, and second, a predilection to engage in block voting. These Christians, according to the Times, were using block voting and substantial financial resources to single out politicians in both parties who do not share their religion-based views. Is that Maud with the deep pockets? This set them apart from other Americans who tirelessly promote politicians who disagree with them. For 20 years, evangelical Christians had been portrayed as toothless hicks preaching for a nickel in the Ozarks. then seamlessly.